been involved in sort of the grand poobahs of the Baptist world, something like that. I don't know what.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. But I think one thing I always appreciate, and you make space for people. Like, I remember you've organised the Chaplain's Day for the Baptist Hui, and you have lots of different people sharing, and you sort of notice people who are not kind of the shining lights necessarily in the movement, but you notice people and you invite them to be part of things. And I think you make space for people, and you sort of step back so others can take the space that you were standing in. And I think that is something that's been so beautiful for me. And you're a bit of a legend. The other thing is, you might notice, I don't think Dave's here today, but there's your brother's been coming to Long to Island, and he looks remarkably like you. And I always have to take a second look every time. But this is not Dave, this is Paul.
E te whanau o te ariki, e ho mā, ko hui mai nei ki tēnei wharikura. He wharikura kia te ata nei. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Nā mihi nui, nā mihi araha, kia koutou katoa, e roto e te araha me te kaha, te tumanako, te rangamāri e, o tō tātou kaihanga, ihu kraiti. Greetings everyone this morning, in the schoolhouse, which you have turned into a house of prayer. And that's pretty good, isn't it? And so greetings to you all. It's great to be here. And thank you, Helen, for those very kind words. And thank you for the welcome to come and share with you today. I want to get straight into it. Today, it's a personal reflection, our story, living with loss. And I want to tell you about an important day. Some time ago, we lived on a rural block, two houses adjoining, our son Steve and his wife Elizabeth and their grown family, and Leslie and me next door. And we did life together, lots of meals, lots of conversations, work on the block and all that kind of stuff. Great. And one particular weekend, Steve came over to the house and probably drinking coffee. He's a bit of an addict like me. And Steve talked to his mum about a verse that he had been reading and thinking deeply about. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, his justice, and everything else will fall into place. And Steve had been grappling with this and trying to work out what that meant in his life, and how he was going to work that out in his circumstances, and was pondering deeply about that. And he and his mum had this conversation, and it was left hanging. It wasn't completed, but there was a very precious conversation. And as it turned out, that was the last conversation that his mum had with her son. It was only a day or two later that he wasn't with us. And so that verse has, it's always been important and something we've known, but it's taken on another level of meaning for us as a family, as you can imagine, and has become a kind of a mantra in some kind of ways. And there's a photo here of Steve, and then I've got a photo here. We wrote that verse on his casket, and we remember those words. Maybe there are some people who live a charmed life and everything goes their way, nothing goes wrong. They don't have setbacks, disasters, failures, losses, no suffering, no grief. I guess it's possible there are such people, but I'm not one, and I've never met one. I think the reality is that pain and loss and suffering, grief, are normal parts of life. They are an inevitable part of our experience, and none of us can stop bad stuff breaking into our lives. And that bad stuff can come in all sorts of ways. It might be the loss of hopes and dreams. It might be what the boss says to you about your job finishing, or what the bank manager says to you about your financial state, or what the doctor tells you about the state of your health and what the tests have shown, you know, or what your family says to you, you know, what your Loved ones might say to you that you don't want to hear. It might be what the policeman says to you about what's happened. There's a multitude of ways in which trouble can come. Sometimes you see it coming, and sometimes it just comes out of nowhere, doesn't it? And just blindsides you completely. And we have no control over the troubles that come our way. And of course, we all live with the knowledge that at the end of it, we all die. We lose this life. No one gets out alive. Many years ago, I bought a great little book, and it's got a wonderful title, Don't Waste Your Sorrows. And the author says that you can't stop sorrow impacting your life and changing you as a person, but you can influence the kind of impact that pain and suffering have on you, the kind of changes that they are going to make in you. And the changes might be damaging and destructive, perhaps in a long-term kind of way. And we've probably all seen that happen in people's lives. Or you can work in such a way that the impact of the troubles you've suffered end up being used in some constructive and positive kind of way within you. In a sentence, your troubles are either going to make you or break you. I've come to the conclusion that our troubles come from three different sources. First up, it's the stuff that happens at our own stupid fault. That's me, you know, been there, done that. You know, the dumb choices I do and the consequences that come from that. And then, of course, there's the other people's dumb stuff, their thoughtlessness, or perhaps even their deliberate, hurtful, malicious kind of words or actions that they might do. And I've been there too. But then there's some pain that comes out of nowhere. It just seems random. Like the day Steve went to work. Another day fighting a fire. Another day doing the job that he loved. And doing a good job and being there for people. But that day he didn't come home. Instead, his brother and sister Pete and Amy and one of his good mates, Liam, had to drive into town to the hospital, to the morgue, to identify his body. And what a drive that was. And I still have flashbacks driving down that road. We missed Steve every day. We loved him. He was a marvellous son for me and his mum, Leslie. He was a much-loved husband to Elizabeth and a much-loved father to his two kids, Isabel and Bowie. A close friend to me and the family and many friends. Tears come easily. I drove home from watching the rugby last night with my two daughters and their husbands and their kids, and we had a great old evening. You know what it's like, you know, sitting around watching the telly, having a drink and a yarn. And I drove home and the tears came. Steve loved those kind of occasions. He should have been there, but he wasn't. I've got some photos. A quick little picture of our son. He was one of the 1990, you know, the 150 years since the Treaty Boys on the telly. He and Wayne Tuapawa were picked out to front those TV ads. I am apologies these photos. If you're a vegetarian or a signed up member of the anti-gun lobby, perhaps you should close your eyes. That's Steve and his two sisters, Mount Hikarangi, up on the east coast in the background, out roaming the hills. Wedding day. Steve and Liz. Helicopter pilot. SAS soldier. That particular night, they rescued 70 people in the Hotel Continental in Kabul. We got a letter from a lady who was rescued that night. She thought she was going to die. I shot the pig, by the way. But Steve carrying it, and my son-in-law Tomo with a hat on, and my other son Pete in the background. Steve loved the mountains. It's up on Mount Cook. And loved the hills. Steve and Liz. Being a dad changed him. He loved family life. That's the night before he died. That's his machine, fighting the fires on the Port Hills. This kind of loss shakes you to the core of your being. Pain, grief, suffering make you ask questions that you've never asked before, or perhaps you ask those questions with a vehemence that you have never experienced before. What's going on, God? What's the story? Where are you? Where were you when this dreadful thing happened? Is there any meaning to this? How are we going to survive this? How do I survive? Where are the answers? This morning, on behalf of Leslie, We would like to share some of the things that we've learned and things we're learning together in our, as a family, in our deep grief. And more than that, we'd like to share with you some Bible wisdom about living with loss. And we want to encourage you that whatever you're going through or might go through in the future, Leslie and I know that we have grown and matured in these years since Steve's accident. We've grown deeper with God, with each other, with our family and friends, in some good ways. Actually, in some exciting ways. Crazy as though that might sound. So what I want to do today, kind of two halves. First, you know, don't waste your sorrows. So let's talk about quickly, without recommending any of them, how to waste your sorrows, because I think it's good to identify those things, and then I want to focus obviously more on how not to waste your sorrows. So first up, let's get how to waste your sorrows out of the way. The kinds of things we all do, but it's helpful not to get stuck in. First up, denial. You know, I'm not in pain. I'm tough. I'm strong. I can get through this. I can cope. I'm okay. I've got my big boy, big girl pants on, and I'm getting on with life. And you can do this in a very religious, very Christian kind of way. Well, I'm a Christian, you know, and Jesus was with me, and I'm victorious, and I'm above all this. And I say, you're kidding yourself. I think it's dishonest and unhelpful to kind of take that kind of approach as denial. Remember what Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn, for they are the ones who will be comforted. If you want the comfort of God, you've got to go through the mourning. There's no shortcuts. And so we mourn, we grieve, but it's in that that we experience the comfort of God. If you're in denial, then you're being dishonest about your pain, and God can't comfort you. Secondly, self-medicate. Plenty of options, aren't there? Alcohol and drugs, whether they're legal or illicit. Or you can throw yourself into some kind of distraction, sport or work or hobby or whatever that might be. Self-medicating doesn't really work, doesn't solve the problem, and often makes the problem a whole lot worse. Another bad idea is getting angry. Blame someone, something. You know, people have different ways of getting angry. Some quietly smoulder, and some go volcanic. But either way, it's anger. And it's a natural response to pain. Some people get really angry at themselves. And all that does is allow the anger to eat away at them and exacerbates the problem. Of course, if you've got the idea that it's God's job to look after you and make your life sweet now that you've signed up to follow him, then when trouble comes, it's very easy to feel terribly let down and disappointed. Hey, hang on a minute, God, I thought the deal was you love me and you're going to look after me and make my life easy. And this doesn't fit. And if you take that approach, it's going to be in trouble because God didn't actually say that he's going to make your life easy and it's all about comforting you and giving you a magic carpet ride through life. He said he'd be with you in all the different things that happen in life. Here's an important fact. It's okay to tell God how you feel, to be honest with him. It's okay actually to rant and rave at God. And if you don't believe me, I'll show you some passages in the Bible where lots of people ranted and raved at God about stuff that was going on. And God's big enough. He can handle that no problem at all. Where are you, God? You know, what are you up to? Can't you see our troubles? Come on, do something. What's not helpful is getting trapped by anger. It gets in the way of listening and learning, processing stuff and growing. Another way that's not helpful, our world tells us that you can always trust your feelings. A couple of Americans wrote a book, The Coddling of the American Mind. One of the lies that so many people believe is you can trust your feelings. It's a lie. Our feelings, our emotions are a wonderful gift from God. They're part of being made in the image of God. But when we let our feelings run our lives, we're heading for trouble. The Bible tells us the heart is extremely deceitful. So it tells us to take every thought captive so that we can be transformed by the changing of our minds. If we let our feelings take charge, we'll be toast. There's a choice, you know. We can let our feelings do all the talking to us, or actually we can start to talk to our feelings. And in the Psalms, David the psalmist talks to his feelings. He says, "Why are you cast down, O my soul? And why are you so upset deep within me?" And responding to our feelings and processing and analysing them is a whole lot better than just being driven by them. And then withdraw. Some people let suffering isolate them. They think to themselves, look at everybody else. They're getting on with life and it's normal and it's usual and they're doing fine. And they don't know what I'm going through. They don't know the depth of my suffering, my pain. And that's probably true. In fact, I'm sure it's often true. We each have our own experience, our own feelings that sometimes we can hardly explain to ourselves. And not even to the people that are closest to us, let alone anyone else. But it's a mistake to shut other people out and to isolate ourselves. And these experiences of pain and grief is when we really need other people round about us who will listen to us and understand us as much as they can. Isolating works against us, not for us. And then the last one I want to mention, although I'm sure I haven't exhausted the list of possibilities, is self-absorption. And it's not surprising that when you're going through great grief and pain and loss, that you kind of become absorbed in yourself and your own experience. And it makes it harder to think about other people and to understand where they're at. Our energy's all been used up coping with our own troubles, our own situation. Self-absorption, I think, can influence us in a variety of ways. Some people feel shame and condemnation. You know, it's very easy to feel shame and guilt when we shouldn't. Sometimes we don't feel it when we should. But sometimes we feel those things when we shouldn't, and we can start to think all this bad stuff must be happening for a reason. There must be something wrong in my life. You know, maybe God doesn't like me as much as I thought. You know, that kind of thing. Maybe I deserve it. It's God's punishment or it's life's punishment. My place to suffer. Not helpful. And in a funny, perverse kind of way, suffering can become our friend. We become so absorbed that it becomes part of our life. What do I mean by that? Suffering becomes our identity. It's who we are. Well, I'm a sufferer. My life is really bad. Do you know that? You know? I've got this terrible situation, and it becomes part of who we are. And given the chance, I reckon self-pity can become quite addictive. Our suffering can also become an excuse for behaviour that otherwise we wouldn't tolerate. And some sufferers actually start to feel a bit superior to others. Oh, you call that suffering? Man, you don't know what I'm going through. You know, so you've got to kind of hang on to it. And I've met people who actually, it seems to me, are quite happy being miserable. They don't really want to face up to the challenge of change. It's why Jesus asked people, do you want to be well? So to conclude the first half, here's a useful question to ask yourself. And the stuff that you deal with or might deal with in the future, is your reaction to that helping you or is it hindering you? When things go wrong, when you suffer loss and you're in grief, is your reaction to it helping you or hindering you? I think that's a useful question. I'll leave it with you. But let's move on. How to not waste your sorrows. First thing I want to mention is to be prepared. Here in Canterbury, of course, we have learned that the time to prepare for an earthquake is not when the place starts shaking. There's no time then, is there? You do your preparation before the troubles come. When someone dies, it's too late to say sorry, to sort out the difficulties, to resolve resentments. One of the things that really helped us was that when Steve died, we realised that he had left no unresolved conflicts, no lingering tensions. There was no one who was wishing, oh man, I so wish I'd gone and talked to him about whatever. And without realising it, in many ways he was prepared to die. Jesus told the story about two builders who each built a house. And they both ended up, I reckon, with nice looking homes. However, one builder saved a lot of coin because he didn't put a foundation underneath. Well, who can see the foundation anyway? You can build a nice house, you know, without having the foundation underneath. And you know, these days you've got to have the latest riprap foundation and all that kind of stuff, more steel, more concrete, and it costs a lot more money. And for a time, both houses looked fine. And I guess the first builder felt really smug. I've done a great job, I've got a nice house, and I've got all that money still in the bank. But then one day, as you know the story, the storm came. And the house on the sand with no foundation fell down. And the house on the strong foundation stood firm. The time to build foundations is now, not when the troubles come. Back in 2010, the first earthquake hit Canterbury and then the terrible one in February 2011, and there was loads of aftershocks. And as Helen mentioned, at that time I was pastoring the church at Kaiapoi, and we had 1,600 homes in our wider area ruined, red-stickered by the earthquakes. And I was the regional leader running around the place trying to help out in that situation. We had just started building a house just before all this. And we engaged a good friend who was part of our church to be our builder. And he told us how much money it was going to cost to build the house we had in mind. And things were looking good. But then the bills rolled in and it turned out that he was probably at six figures or more out in his assessment of what it was going to cost. And then he had an affair with another woman and broke up his family and left his wife and kids and then walked off our job. And I used to lie awake at night, tossing and turning and totally stressed out. Where do I get the money from? Am I going to end up with a half-built house? You know? And I just felt such a fool. How did I allow this situation to develop in our family? This is a disaster. And of course, the more you lose sleep, the worse the tensions and struggles become. And I was a mess. And then one night lying in bed, I had this little idea popped in my head. I think I'm going to say Psalm 23 to myself. And so I went through the psalm. David did us a great favour when he wrote these words. And he, of course, had his share of troubles. And some of them he absolutely brought on himself, his own stupid behaviour. And others were caused by his enemies and the people that hated him. And there would have been troubles that came his way that blindsided him like they can blindside us. And it became a habit at that time, when I was getting stressed out, to lie in bed and to say to myself, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me, he makes me lie down in green pastures, he leads me by still waters, he restores my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff are with me." And when I read "your rod and your staff with me," I like to think taiha, you know, a weapon. Because a shepherd's rod and staff were for fighting off animals that wanted lamb for breakfast. Yeah? Wasn't just to lean on. So think taiha. Where am I? "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." But what I didn't know at that time was that I was preparing for a far, far, far more stressful situation that was still to come. I was learning at that time to trust God in deeper ways, and in days to come I was going to need desperately every little bit of what I'd learned at that time. Because you see, I reckon right now we are preparing in our lives for what's to come. And if we look back, are we going to say that preparation was up to it? We are, each of us, preparing for what lies ahead. And so I encourage you to do the best preparation you can. The second thing, be honest with God about your pain. Bad stuff is bad stuff. Pain and grief are pain and grief. And God can handle hearing about your pain. He's not shocked or disappointed in you. God wants us to go to him with our pain and suffering. And C.S. Lewis said, "God whispers to us in our pleasures, but he shouts to us in our pains." And then thirdly, be thankful. You probably know the story of Scott Guy, the 8th of July 2010. Scott Guy, a young dairy farmer up near Fielding in the North Island, was going to work early in the morning and was shot and killed in the driveway of the family farm. And all these years on, Scott's murder remains unsolved. His parents, Brian and Joanne Guy, have written about their loss, about the pain, the shock, the ongoing grief, and about where they're at now. They've written some wonderful things. And Scott Guy's mother, Joanne, said this: "Being thankful every day changed my mindset. I started small, thankful for the sun, which was shining, thankful that I could hear the birds singing, and gradually it became a long list of things I am so thankful for. Look for the good every day. Today might not be a good day, but there is good in every day." Pain and loss can become a snare which traps us, holding us tightly in its grip. Thankfulness is one of the powerful ways to break that grip, to break those chains. And then the next thing, ask God to help you handle your sorrows in such a way that you grow in wisdom and trust, that you become a deeper, richer person. I'm sure you know that a beautiful pearl is created when a bit of grit gets into the oyster, and it responds to that grit and creates a pearl. And beautiful diamonds are created when ordinary old carbon is exposed to huge heat and pressure, and something beautiful is created. Leslie and I read a few days before the first anniversary of Steve's death this quote from Tim Keller: "Troubles can take everything away from you except God. Therefore, if God is to you a greater safety, a deeper security, and a more powerful home than anything else in the world, you fear no trouble. Depending on God in trouble is a spiritual skill that can only be learned in trouble." Unfortunately, that last line is true. It'd be much easier to learn in the good times, wouldn't it? But there's things that we can only learn in the hard times. And another quote that I find very powerful is: "Psalm after psalm demonstrates our sufferings are the context in which we experience the love of God, both to comfort us and to change us. We're comforted in our afflictions as we learn of God's promises and power. We're changed in our afflictions as we learn to take refuge in God rather than in vain idols." We either love God or we love some kind of idol. And in our sufferings, God's often going after the idols in our lives, which have snuck in and made themselves at home, infiltrated our affections. We all trust in something. It's our fortress, it's our strength. Maybe it's our wealth, our health, our friends, our loved ones, our talents, our good looks, our intelligence, our strength. If you've got all of those, you're doing well. Or God. When God is our fortress, our trust in Him is our strength. Even when we can't work out what's going on, what's happening, when it all makes no sense to us, still we are safe. Nothing can overthrow us. The Bible says that all things work together for good, for those who are in God, who love God. It doesn't say all things are good. Clearly they are not. That's for sure. But all things can work for good in our lives. And that's the miracle of what only God can do in us and for us. It's one of the things I love about being a follower of Jesus, that He can take the bad stuff, even the bad stuff, and bring good out of that. Anyone can bring good out of good, and any fool can bring bad out of bad. But it's only God who can bring good out of evil. Out of control jealousy caused Joseph's brothers to sell him into slavery. Terribly cruel rejection. However, years later, Joseph said to them, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." Isn't that an incredible statement? You meant to harm me, and they did. But God brought good out of all this. If we see pain and suffering in our lives as just problems to be solved as quick as possible so we can get back to the good life we deserve, we deny God opportunities to teach us things that we can learn in no other way, to grow us in ways that won't happen otherwise. Sorry about that, but I think it's absolutely true. The quick, easy way out, if you can find one, is most certainly not always the best way to go. And then the next thing I want to say, hang out with people who will help you. There are plenty of unhelpful people out there. Find the helpful ones, and you'll soon learn the difference between them. Helpful people listen. Helpful people very often just give you a big hug and sit with you perhaps. And they don't give you pat answers and little sayings and, you know, trite comments and try and make it all better with a few words, because they know that there's no words that'll take the pain away. I learned a really important lesson one day years ago, a lesson for which I'm very thankful. We lived up on the east coast of North Island and we were at Atangi at Hiraharama. And I was in the line of people coming up to greet and hungi the bereaved family. And in good family tradition, I was trying to think of some really nice, good, appropriate words to say to these grieving people as I came closer to them. And I looked up the line and I saw people ahead of me greeting the bereaved family. And I noticed something. No one was saying anything. They were looking at one another. They were embracing. They shared a hungi, the breath of life. There were tears and no words. And it was kind of like God said to me, shut up, you dumb pākehā. There are no words that'll fix this. I was a bit surprised that God could speak like that. But when I got over my surprise, I thought, I've learned something. That is so important. So important. They've just lost a loved one. I can't make it better with a few words. But I can be here with them. And I can share some love. And pray that God will bless them and guide them and comfort them. Helpful people certainly won't tell you about the tough times they've been through, as if that means they know what you're going through. When you're overwhelmed with grief and loss, it's not nice words that you need, but you need understanding and love and the presence of people who care. Some quick things to finish, a few more. If they're believers, they'll pray with you. It might not be a very long prayer. It might be a prayer with far more questions than answers. But together with you, they'll come to God. And we'll talk to God. And I was encouraged, delighted this morning, because I have very seldom been to a church service where there's been a song that's been called a lament. In our world, we love the party, don't we? We love the celebration and success and joy and all that kind of stuff. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. It's good. But there is another side to life. And there's a time for lament. And we need a theology of celebration and a theology of lament. And if you don't have an understanding of loss and pain and suffering, if you get blindsided by it, you're ill-equipped to deal with what's happening and it can make the whole situation even worse. So read the exciting stuff in the Bible and the good stories, but don't shy away from the Psalms of the lament and the prophets who lamented and the Book of Lamentations, which is an unrelenting lament. We've got to learn celebration. You know, we're the people who can party better than anybody, I reckon. And we're also the people who can cry really well and lament properly. And I think also that it's important to work out the difference between happiness and joy. They're not the same thing. They don't mean the same. And especially for us as Christians, they are different. Happiness is a wonderful feeling. We all like being happy, don't we? And of course, there is a time and place for feeling sad. But joy is not another word for happiness. Happiness is a feeling. Joy is actually a state of being. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit. It's something that God can grow in us. It's not dependent on circumstances. For the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross and despised the shame. Count it all joy, my brothers and sisters, when hard times come. It's true. We can know joy and experience pain at the same time. The last thing. Hope is one of the first casualties of loss and suffering. When disaster strikes, hope goes out the window. Despair flies in and makes itself at home. How do you find hope when your heart is broken? You can't conjure it up within yourself. Hope is a gift that God gives. And we sang about that earlier. Open your heart to God and he will inspire hope. So what are you doing with your troubles? Wasting them or using them for good? The passage I want to finish with tells us something incredibly important. The God of the Bible, the God we Christians serve, it's not some divine being who lived a charmed life of supernatural powers and a way above all pain and suffering. Not at all. The God we can come to know and trust came as a human being to share in our suffering and our sorrows and our joys. And he made a way home to the Father for us through his own terrible suffering and loss. God knows our joys and our sorrows. He's no stranger to suffering. And the great day is coming, as we sang earlier, when there'll be no more mourning or crying or pain. God himself will wipe every tear from our eyes. Hebrews 4. So then, since we have a great high priest who has entered heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. This high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced all the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So let us come boldly to the throne of our gracious God. There we will receive his mercy and find grace to help us when we need it most. Maybe you, like me, are walking a road of pain and suffering. Lots of us are, in various ways. I want to lovingly and gently point you to Jesus, the shepherd who cares for his sheep, the saviour who gave his life for us, the king who reigns in glory and is coming back to restore his creation to the full beauty and glory he intended. What a day that will be. A day to either fear or a day to welcome with overwhelming joy. And right now, seek first the kingdom of God. Above all else, live righteously, seek justice, and everything else will fall into place. May God bless you.